Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's the News Roundup, where we talk to area journalists about the stories making regional news this week. With summer weather finally here, Nantucket Sound is warming up, and that meant it was finally time for the first release this year of rehabilitated sea turtles. CAI's Jeanette Barnes was on West Dennis Beach on Wednesday to see 17 turtles released by staff and volunteers from the New England Aquarium, and she is joining us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So first, tell us about these turtles. Why were they getting care from the aquarium?
Well, these turtles were stranded and cold stunned by cold water in Cape Cod Bay over last fall and winter. They were apparently unable to get out of the bay and head south as they normally would before the water got too cold. So this is not that unusual. And when they're found, they get taken to the New England Aquarium's Sea Turtle Hospital in Quincy. They're treated for a variety of things like hypothermia, pneumonia, sometimes some physical injuries. And as I said, it's not uncommon for turtles to get caught in the bay at that time of year. But Adam Kennedy, who is the director of the rescue and rehabilitation program there at the New England Aquarium, he said that the number of turtles found cold stunned in the bay is increasing, especially for the Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, which are critically endangered. He says the most likely reason for that is that the Gulf of Maine is getting warmer. So when waters are warm, the turtles move north, and then more of them get stuck inside the arm of the Cape when they're intending to head south for the winter. And these are pretty big numbers, actually, overall, that even though only 17 were released this week, more than 500 cold stunned sea turtles went to the aquarium last season. Many of them get sent to other facilities around the country, but there are still 25 more at that hospital in Quincy that they're going to be releasing at some point.
Hmm. Now, you went to West Dennis Beach where they were releasing the turtles. What was it like? Share a little bit of the scene for us. I imagine it was pretty exciting.
Sure. Yes, it was. It was my first time seeing this with these rehabilitated turtles. The aquarium had roped off an area maybe 30 plus feet wide. So they had like one rope on one side, one on the other to make sort of a passageway for the turtles so that onlookers would stand on the sides. They try to minimize the spectators to not stress the turtles out. But there were people standing alongside those ropes. They brought out the 17 turtles, each in a separate plastic bin. They set the bins on the sand. Some of them were quite large, actually. And then they would pick up each turtle, carry the turtle down closer to the water's edge, put it on the sand near the water. And the turtles mostly walked in on their own. There was one that kind of drew some laughs for turning around the wrong direction and walking the wrong way. But generally, they knew what to do and they went right in.
Hmm. I can imagine just the little kids watching this. This would be so exciting.
Yeah.
They were releasing three different species of turtles. You mentioned the Kemp Ridleys. Tell us a little bit about these three species.
Yes. So all of them are endangered or threatened. They had 9 of the Kemp's Ridleys. 5 loggerheads, and 3 green sea turtles. The New England Aquarium numbers each of these turtles. They also give them names each year that are kind of organized around a theme. And this year was Greek mythology. So they have names like Helen and Zeus and things like that. But it is too soon to know if they're male or female, which was surprising to me because the turtles seem pretty large. Yeah, but Adam Kennedy from the aquarium said they are all still too young to know.
Wow. Now, I know one of the turtles suffered a particularly bad injury.
That's right. This one is named Taichi. It is a Kemp's Ridley sea turtle number 688, and it's stranded in December in Wellfleet. It had a scabbed overhead injury. It wasn't a fresh injury, but it was, partially healed. And the aquarium really wasn't sure how well this turtle was going to recover. We have a clip of Adam Kennedy from the aquarium talking about that.
A good chunk of its face was really kind of almost missing, very scabbed over. Not sure what caused it. We were nervous that the jaw wasn't going to be able to consume food and that the turtle might not make it.
Yes, but the turtle did continue to heal very well. One of the things that the aquarium does before they release them is test them on hunting live crabs. And this turtle 688 was able to hunt live crabs with that healed jaw.
Wow. And some of the turtles are tagged, right? So where do they usually go once they're released?
Yes, they are tagged. They all have a microchip, actually, similar to what you might have in your pet. But, you know, that has to be scanned to be useful. So they don't always end up getting scanned. But 10 of the turtles were given satellite tags. Those are easy to track, right? Because they ping every time, you know, they're near or they ping constantly, pretty much. But the satellite tags only last up to a year. So of those 10, 8 of the turtles also have acoustic tags. They last for years, but they do require the turtle to pass near a receiver in order to be detected, which is just like the shark tags that we've reported about before. In terms of where they go, Adam Kennedy from the New England Aquarium says a lot of the turtles will actually stay right in Nantucket Sound for the whole summer.
Wow.
Because there's a lot of good food for them here. Some of the green sea turtles go more deeper into inlets and things like that. And then eventually they will all make their way south.
Now, you reported on another water-related story this week as well, and that was the Cape Cod Commission released its new freshwater strategy.
Yes, that is right. This is something they've been working on for about 3 years with input from the community and organizations and so on. Cape Cod has a lot of ponds, as many of us know, 890 freshwater ponds and lakes on the Cape. So the idea here with this report was really to provide the most up-to-date guidance about how to protect the water quality in the ponds, restore quality where it's been degraded, and look at ways that strategies that can be applied across the region.
What are some of the recommendations that they're making?
Well, one key thing that the Cape Cod Commission is recommending is to continue the regional pond monitoring program, which does water testing. They also want to expand that testing, do more of it. And one thing they'd really like to see is expanded availability of laboratories to handle the testing. That would reduce the travel time for samples and just make it easier to have more comprehensive testing. They also recommended that the Cape develop a regional program to cooperate on applying for state and federal grants. So there are 13 of these recommendations in all. The report also points out some existing tools that they say can be very useful. One is a document called Pond Buffer Guidance. So that is full of information about protecting a pond with a vegetated buffer, what to plant, how to do it, to protect ponds from runoff, because many of the ponds have privately owned land around them, and people are affecting the ponds by what they do on their own property. Another tool is called the Cape Cod Water Quality Data Portal. This has been around for a while for marine water, but now they have added freshwater to this tool. This is online, and it's like an interactive map that you can use to look at elements of water quality data around the Cape.
And we'll have a link to that freshwater report in the story at our website, capeandislands.org. But before you go, I want to talk briefly about offshore wind, because there's an important deadline coming up on Monday. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So Monday is the scheduled deadline for contract signing for the state's latest round of offshore wind contracts. But as we've been reporting, it's really not clear if any of the three developers that were selected in September plan to sign those contracts because of a few factors. Excuse me. The biggest one probably is President Trump's executive order stopping the permitting of offshore wind farms. And even before he took office, you know, he had taken this position that he was going to stop wind development. So some of these decisions even started to be made before that. But one of the three companies that received a contract award was essentially forced to drop out. That was Vineyard Offshore, which was planning Vineyard Wind 2. So when these contract awards happened, their award from Massachusetts was relying on Connecticut to buy some of the power from the wind farm. Massachusetts wasn't going to buy it all alone. Connecticut made the decision not to do that. So Vineyard Wind 2 was not able to move forward. So now we're left with two for this possible contract signing Monday. One is New England Wind One. The other is South Coast Wind. Neither of the companies behind those projects would talk to me this week, but South Coast Wind said that it plans to issue a statement on Monday. It's also possible that the state could postpone the deadline for signing of those contracts and just say kind of like, we're going to wait and see if, you know, if this is going to be able to go forward at a later date, depending on the climate. But the state wouldn't comment. And also these contracts, the date that they're supposed to be signing these contracts, which is coming up Monday, has already been delayed 4 times. Wow. So we will see.
We will see. And you'll stay on it. Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mindy.
Yep. New Bedford hires a new police chief who's coming from Hartford, Connecticut. Anastasia Lennon from the New Bedford Light joins us with that story. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So Jason Thody spent 30 years at the Hartford Police Department, introduced at a press conference this week with Mayor John Mitchell. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yep. So it was much anticipated, but the city, Mayor Mitchell administration, kept a tight seal on who was going to be the new pick for police chief. Rumors swirled whether it would be an internal candidate or an external candidate, and people surmised it might be an outsider just given the scrutiny the department has been under following, you know, a big Boston Globe investigation into, you know, decades of misconduct in the narcotics division and allegations against its very own police chief who retired in May. That's Chief Paul Olivera. And so, yep, on Tuesday, Mayor Mitchell announced that Jason Thody, who had been the chief in Hartford, Connecticut just last year, had retired from that position, is going to take the helm at New Bedford.
What do we know about his time in Connecticut?
Yep, so he served, you know, almost 3 decades in Hartford, so he went up the ranks, and he was chief in his last 5 years. Mayor Mitchell said that he ushered in several reforms during his leadership. You know, improved the citizen complaint process. So, right, when citizens want to complain about misconduct of officers, and said he was a very data-driven person, and the city has been interested and wants to modernize the department, and, you know, a term they use was 21st century policing. And so, you know, he said that this guy is a good fit for the job. Still, you know, Thody was not without his own issues. There was a vote of no confidence by Hartford Police Union while he was chief. And also while he was chief, there was a single car accident in which he was involved. And witnesses reported that he was driving erratically. Thody had said he was just driving distractedly. But city councilors and officials there said there wasn't enough accountability or transparency with that incident. And earlier, while he was a lieutenant, he was the aggressor in a bar altercation while he was off duty. So, you know, there are some issues people that's been reported on that people are wondering, you know, if he's best suited for the job. But the Mitchell administration maintains that he's a great fit, you know, to continue improvements in the department here.
Mayor Mitchell, a proponent of community policing, and as you said, what he calls 21st century policing. And I was like, what does that look like? What does that mean? What is 20?
Yeah, it's, I guess, one of those term, industry terms, jargon. But yeah, I mean, it's very much about modernization and community policing. But then you might ask, well, what does community policing mean, right? But it's about, you know, bridging connections with the community, being, you know, meeting face to face, and you know, building relationships, not just to, you know, go out there and arrest people and enforce the law, but really, you know, be a resource for folks. And, you know, on the modernization side, Mitchell again emphasized that this guy is very data driven. He was working, you know, on a data project for the state of Connecticut. It's still listed as his current role on LinkedIn, but, you know, that's about collecting data and making decisions based on data. And so what that could look like is the department, you know, analyzing information on the type of stop it's conducting, and perhaps the racial breakdown of who is conducting stops on. And yeah, there's all sorts of data, right, a police department can collect. And so,
And I know a lot of concern about the ICE raids. And did he say anything about his future relationship or potential relationship with ICE?
Yep, so I had that same question, and I asked him that at the press conference. As most of us are aware, that there's been a real uptick of activity in New Bedford, where there are big immigrant communities. And the previous chief, Oliveira, you know, said it's not that they were going to actively work with ICE, but if ICE requested information, they'd offer it, and that he also wouldn't bar his officers from cooperating or working with ICE and providing information. And so I asked Sodi what his position on that is. And he said, you know, in one part, it's a political question, and that this is something that, you know, the mayor is going to advise on. He said when he was the chief in Hartford that they did not cooperate with ICE, and that was under the directive of that mayoral administration. Mm-hmm. So he said he'd have to talk with Mitchell to see, you know, Mitchell's stance. But also he stressed the importance of working with law enforcement agencies, even those with whom one doesn't agree or takes issue with. And so he stressed the importance of having a working relationship with ICE. How that will look, we don't know, but the mayor weeks or months ago now took issue with the federal agency because it wasn't providing timely or accurate information about the enforcement operations in the city. So time will tell, you know, whether the relationship's going to change at all on the city's end and how it approaches that.
Yeah. Anastasia Lennon, thanks so much. Anastasia's with the New Bedford Light. Thanks for bringing us up to date on the new police chief. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Mindy. Bye.
The extreme heat wave this week forced the New Bedford Fairhaven Bridge to close on Tuesday and Wednesday, halting marine traffic and forcing cars and trucks to detour during the afternoons. For the New England News Collaborative, Ben Burke has more for us.
Every hour, the steel bridge in the center of America's busiest fishing port swings open, allowing boats to squeeze by on their way out to sea. But on both Tuesday and Wednesday, the bridge got stuck as the temperature rose above 90 degrees. Fairhaven's harbor master, Timothy Cox, explains why.
When the heat is like it is today and yesterday, when the bridge opens, the steel will expand.
When the New Bedford Fairhaven Bridge tries to swing shut, it can't snap into place anymore because it's suddenly too big. That shuts down a busy state highway into a city of 100,000 people and keeps a big chunk of the fishing fleet stuck in the harbor. MassDOT has a plan to replace this 120-year-old bridge that'll take at least a couple years. But for now, the bridge may be shutting down more than it used to. Climate scientists say we're facing more extreme heat than ever before. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Ben Burke.
The New Bedford Fairhaven Bridge reopened Wednesday night as the temperatures dropped. Interestingly, Casco Bay Bridge in Portland, Maine had similar heat-related issues this week. Coming up July 1st, some research databases will be cut off at libraries statewide. We'll have that and more. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. July 1st is next week, and that is when some research databases will be cut off at libraries statewide, including here on Cape Cod. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with more on that story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So you checked in with several libraries. This is really a little bit disturbing, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And this all comes down from federal budget cuts. The Institute of Museum and Library Services, IMLS, as it's called, is an independent federal agency that provides libraries nationwide with funding for things like research databases. And the state library board of library commissioners has said that they're losing quite a bit of funding because of the cuts to the federal program. And what that is going to mean is a loss of quite a few research databases that many libraries in the area take advantage of. You know, they're losing about $1.7 million in funding beginning the new fiscal year. They don't know how much that is going to, if there's going to be more losses after that when the new federal budget bill is approved. But local libraries are scrambling to figure out a way to how they can save some of these databases.
Yeah, what are some of the databases that they're looking at?
The ones that they're looking at discontinuing at this point include Boston Globe Archives, Britannica databases, science databases, some related to career testing, and a whole slew of databases that are in fields such as U.S. history and science and law and health and wellness. You know, a lot of these things that are databases that students use, for instance, to do research papers and things like that.
Yeah. Are there any legal options that could restore those cuts?
You know, short of the budget of this agency, this federal agency being restored, and the administration has indicated that their plan is to completely eliminate this agency. So it's kind of a long shot that the funding will be restored, perhaps maybe a little bit. So local libraries are kind of scrambling. The Chatham Library here told us that they're trying to look at repurposing some of their funding, as well as the Brewster Library. They said the same thing. They're looking at some funding that they have from the state for ebooks and audiobooks, maybe repositioning some of that to retain some of these databases. There will be some databases that will continue. They're hoping to, the state is continuing a number of them. But there's going to be a big void, I think, in the ability to do research through these databases coming July 1st.
In another story you're reporting this week, the First Parish in Brewster honoring some enslaved people who were baptized there.
Yeah, the First Parish Brewster unveiled a bronze plaque last weekend, which commemorates 20 people that they know of who attended the church who were enslaved or were baptized at the church. And it's part of a long effort of social justice that this congregation has taken on. And what they've done is they've put the names of 14 of those people on this plaque and acknowledge that there are at least six others that they don't know the names of. And it's a way that they're trying to, you know, sort of commemorate these people, and they also will be donating something like $10,000 to the Wampanoag Language School in Mashpee as a step towards reparation. This congregation feels very strongly about, you know, making up for the sins of the past, so to speak.
And that's not easy, researching the connection of the church to enslaved people. You know, records are not exactly accurate, right? So this is not an easy task.
Yeah, it's taken them several years to do this. And, you know, the church has, this church goes back to the 1700s in starting in Harwich and then when it became Brewster. So they have quite a bit of material, but, you know, going through those records and trying to figure out who the people were who were enslaved and you know, what their names were, it's just a big task. And you know, kudos to them for taking on this project and following it through.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, thanks.
Thank you, Mindy.
The Cape Cod Commission is working with the town of Eastham on a plan that will guide the town through the next several years of climate change-related challenges. And this summer, the commission's collecting input on the climate plan from Eastham residents. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke to the Cape Cod Commission Deputy Director Stephen Tupper to learn more about how the plan is being developed and how people can participate. Here's their conversation.
Stephen, tell me a little bit about how the Eastham Climate Action Plan got started.
So the town of Eastham has always had a priority in terms of projects to increase the resiliency of their community, broadly under the climate action category. What they would like to do is have a dedicated effort to develop a local climate action plan where they can work to prioritize future projects within the town and understand some of the threats to the community. And overall, this would work in with existing planning efforts in town and be an avenue to identify projects and prioritize those locally.
In a recent press release, you folks reported that 20% of Eastham's properties are located within the special flood hazard zone. What does that mean for Eastham residents, and what other kinds of climate challenges does the town face?
In many ways, Eastham is defined by its coastal areas, and it's certainly something that the residents love about the community, but certainly puts them on the front line of some of the impacts from major storms that are happening with increasing frequency and severity due to our changing climate. So that's certainly a threat if you happen to own one of those houses on the coast, but it's also a threat in terms of the overall community. It takes a lot of resources to think about those areas on the coast. And as you lose houses on the coast, it also affects the overall tax base. Folks should care about that, whether or not they live on the coast. Then beyond those particular impacts, there's a lot of other impacts across the community. It affects the livelihood of many within the community. Certainly those based in terms of the tourism economy are really affected when we see some changes in climate. And then to give another specific example, we understand that fishing and aquaculture is a significant portion of the community of Eastham, and we're seeing changes in climate, changes in temperatures of water, and certainly affecting the livelihood of those that rely on the ocean.
So this summer, the Cape Cod Commission is going all over Eastham trying to get community input on this project, and you guys have already gotten started. So how has that been going so far?
It's been great. So we wanted to make sure to hear from as many perspectives as possible in the town of Eastham. So we started by talking with all of the town departments that in some way touched this topic. And then I've been in this suite of outreach activities recently. So we've had focus groups with those in the business community, youth focus group, and we're having one with seniors as well. And then we've had less formal pop-ups across the community. I'm trying to meet folks where they are, whether it be at the Eastham Public Library. We'll be out on the beaches this summer with the Energy and Climate Committee in the town of Eastham at the farmers market recently, and we'll be out there again. And having a number of other pop-ups like at the swap shop to trying to have some informal opportunities to get feedback on this plan.
What does the timeline for this project look like?
Overall, we'll be working through the course of this calendar year to develop the plan. So right now we're in the uptake phase. We're listening to input from the community, including those pop-ups and the workshop that we have coming up. We'll be developing a draft plan with the town in the fall. At that point, we'll come back to the community for feedback on the draft plan, and then it'll be up to the town to potentially approve the plan early next year.
What else do you want people to know about the Eastham Climate Action Plan?
We understand some of these things take resources and take funding. So one of the explicit outcomes here is to put the town in a position to go after additional funding. They've been very successful doing that so far, but this is another way to build up to opportunities in that space.
What other opportunities will people have to weigh in on this project?
The workshop will be coming up on July 29th at Eastham Public Library from 6 to 7:30. We'd like to hear from anyone who's concerned about the future of Eastham and thinks that there may be some activities that would make sense to support the town. Whether you have some really specific ideas that you'd like to share, if you just like to learn more, or if you're concerned about some of the things going on in town, this is an open forum here to listen and look forward to some conversation.
That's Stephen Tupper, Deputy Director of the Cape Cod Commission. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gilda.
For more information on the Eastham Climate Action Plan and how you can make your voice heard, you can check out more at our website, capeandislands.org. Electric dirt bikes are all the rage, especially among teens and young adults, but on the Vineyard, there is no place to ride them legally. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times joined us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
So where are these bikes being ridden?
If you drive around town, you'll probably see them. Our reporter, Nick Fakota, went out he's a sports reporter, and he just went to the high school and saw a few of them around. But people are seeing them, and this is where I think the real issue is. People are seeing them on bike paths, kind of zooming around. But, the Island Police Department came to us basically to get the word out, through a warning to parents that, you know, they just aren't. There's nowhere legally to ride these on the island. One particular and popular offender, and we've seen these, are a kind of bike called a Suron. And they look like your typical dirt bike, kind of the big treads on the tires, but they're a little smaller. But they go, you know, some of them go up to 70 miles an hour.
Wow.
We don't know if that's one of the more popular models here, but a lot of them go about 30 miles an hour. Which is pretty fast if you're riding, you know, to school.
Yeah.
And what police are saying, you know, parents don't know, but technically nowhere on the island where I guess you can on private property, but you have to have permission from the landowner. But otherwise, there's just nowhere to go.
Yeah. So 70 miles an hour, that seems like you'd be able to drive with traffic. So can they be registered with RMV and, you know, drive on the roadways like you would with a car?
Yeah. So essentially there are kind of two classifications of electric bikes in Massachusetts. They're, you know, these pedal assist and just straight electric that doesn't need the pedals. Both of them basically boil down to how fast they go. So if you go over 20 miles an hour without pedaling, that technically isn't in that in those two classifications. And it's basically treated like a moped or motorcycle. Mm-hmm. It needs to be registered. You need insurance. But in other words, you can't be a 14-year-old whipping down streets. Police are getting a lot of complaints.
Yeah.
From, you know, if you're riding on the bike path and someone rides by to you at 30 miles an hour, that could be a little frightening.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially when they're younger adults. But, since our story's gone out, I was kind of surprised. We had a lot of reaction. People, I think a lot of bikers are glad to see some publicity about this.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have others who are saying, oh, come on, this is just a fun thing for kids. But I think police, the fact that they came to us with this story, they're basically saying parents don't realize that these are not legal. And they want to get the word out to parents to say, stop buying these for your kids.
Yeah, stop buying. And I mean, when you think about the crowds you have, it really is. It could be a safety concern, yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right. Sam Houghton with the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
Nantucket looking to get a better idea of drug use on the island. And joining us is Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
So I imagine what they're looking at here is both prescription drugs and non-prescription drugs, maybe like fentanyl. What is it they're trying to find?
Yeah, they are. Nantucket's health department is going to actually be utilizing samples that get sent off from the Surfside Wastewater Treatment Facility, the island's sewage plant. They've been doing this for years to test for COVID, and what they're going to start doing is using those samples to also test the sewage for things like opiates, stimulants, cocaine, fentanyl, other illicit substances, really to get sort of a baseline that they believe can help the island's health leaders sort of better understand trends. They can use this as a tool to anticipate sort of when outreach and intervention might become important for the island's substance abuse prevention organizations and medical providers, really to start to get a baseline and then use the data that they collect to better understand, you know, is there a spike happening? Are things, is there certain times of year where this type of drug use goes up or down? So it's going to give them a better picture and a sort of window into this. And as the island's sort of health and human services director said, you know, we kind of have an idea of what the situation is, but they don't really have a lot of direct measurement. So this is sort of getting away from going on their gut and really getting some data and getting a better picture of what's going on.
Are they
going
to look at the difference between summer and off season, or is it just testing now during, you know, the height when people are there?
Yeah, it will be year round. So they're going to start now. Obviously, summer season is here. But these wastewater samples go out once every 2 weeks. So they're going to be getting a sort of complete picture as the year goes along, and they're testing at different times of year. Yes.
Yeah. Thinking of all the visitors we have in the summer, and there's a composter at the Matiket landfill that's been shut down since February. What's happening to all that waste? And I imagine there's a lot more now that the summer visitors have arrived.
Yeah, exactly. We had a tip about this. That the landfills, really one of the biggest pieces of infrastructure out at the Matiket landfill on Nantucket, which is the digester, some people call it the composter, is this sort of cylindrical device that the town feeds all of the municipal solid waste. So just household trash into this digester and composter, and it does make compost. This piece of equipment that is sort of the linchpin of the whole operation out there has been down on offline since February. So now we're here almost to July, and it is still not working. So what the town's landfill operator has been doing, Waste Options Nantucket, is just trucking this municipal solid waste several hundred yards away to an inactive lined landfill cell and basically just stockpiling it until the digester is operational again. Once that happens, Waste Options will, what their word is, exhume the solid waste and feed it through the composter once it's operational again. But that probably won't happen until the fall, given the volume that's been starting to come in now.
Wow.
So, the town just signed its biggest contract that it has with waste options for a new, you know, multi-year contract to operate the landfill. It's the biggest contract that the town has, and they are actually buying back a lot of this equipment at the landfill from waste options, so the town has more control over what happens out there. So yeah. Interesting timing on that development at the landfill.
All right, Vice President J.D. Vance expected on the island. This is for a fundraiser, but I imagine there must be some preparations for potential protests, right?
Yes, absolutely. So we were given the invitation to this event, which is going to be happening on July 22nd. Vice President J.D. Vance is going to be on the island for a fundraiser for the Republican National Committee. If you're, anyone's interested, it is $250,000 per couple
to
be on the host committee, or $100,000 just to sit down for dinner. So this is obviously a big ticket fundraiser for the Republican National Committee. J.D. Vance has been here before on the fundraising circuit during the summer. He was last here as a Senate candidate in 2022 when he was running for Senate in Ohio. But obviously this time will be a much bigger deal as vice president with the security apparatus, with, as you mentioned, what is expected to be a lot of protesters. We've already seen some online activity of people sort of organizing and preparing to, you know, put up flyers all over on, one person said, on every single telephone pole on the island. So we'll see if that actually happens.
More to come on that. Yeah. So, So, and then quickly, give us an update from last week. We talked about the proposed cell phone ban for students. It got approved. School committee approved, right?
It did. So on Wednesday evening, the school committee voted unanimously to approve this new policy, which essentially bans the use of cell phones from the opening morning bell to the end of the day. The students will have to use these magnetically locked bags to stow away their devices for the entire school day. So on Wednesday evening, the school committee heard from teachers, administrators, really urging them to approve this policy, and thinking that these devices are such a distraction for their students, even if they're not supposed to have them, as the current policy states right now, during class time, having them out, you know, in the halls, at lunchtime, in the schools. You know, one person said, well, I think we're going to be getting a lot fewer requests to go to the bathroom during class.
All right, Jason Grazia today from the Nantucket Current. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Coming up after a break, we'll hear from our State House reporter, Katie Lannon, and wastewater, whether to sewer or not. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Wastewater and whether or not to sewer is always a big question facing communities. And in Eastham, voters overwhelmingly approved the construction of a sewer system around the Salt Pond watershed. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent joins us with that story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mindy.
So this was a lot of people voting yes.
Yes, it was. It was a big turnout for a special town meeting on Monday evening this week. The vote in the end was 537-96 in favor of building a new sewer system and waste treatment plant in Eastham, which was for many people a surprisingly large margin.
Yeah, $170 million price tag with that. So how is that going to be funded?
Well, the urgency around this calling this meeting on fairly short notice had to do with the fact that the town had been offered a low or no interest loan from the state revolving fund for $50 million. And this is a renewable, automatically renewable loan. So it sort of operates like a line of credit. There was no guarantee that after June 30th in the next fiscal year that the state revolving fund loans would have that same renewable feature to them. And so town officials in Eastham were saying, we really need to go for this approval now before June expires.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense too when you think about it, when we look at how much wastewater, you know, sewering is the price tag increases all the time. So that makes a lot of sense.
Of course, East Ham is under a mandate, like many other towns, to reduce nitrogen runoff into vulnerable estuaries like the salt pond. The issue was that if they don't build a sewer system, there was a high likelihood that individual homeowners in East Ham would have to put in alternative, innovative septic systems at much higher cost.
Another story you have in Wellfleet, tenants of a new apartment complex could see a delay because of wastewater.
Well, yeah. So, of course, affordable housing is another urgent issue, and Wellfleet is in the middle of constructing a 46-unit development, all affordable units, at Lawrence Hill, right across the street from the Wellfleet Elementary School. And the timeline for that project has a lottery happening this fall with projected move-in dates in the winter, January or February. But it turns out that the cluster wastewater system that's been designed to serve not only those units, but also municipal buildings in the area and some private homes is not going to be ready. In fact, there is no construction schedule right now for the cluster wastewater system. And the town officials, who I have to say have not been very forthcoming about this problem, finally admitted to us that, yes, it probably won't be done on time. The contract with the company that's building it, the Robert B. Auer Company, gives them 450 days to complete the system, and that contract was just signed last month. So they're saying that there may be a backup plan to install tanks, holding tanks for the wastewater in the meantime while the system gets built. But right now, they're not saying anything about whether the actual move-in date for those apartments is going to have to be pushed back or not.
Yeah, well, stay tuned. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Mindy. Take care.
You too. Government transparency, the state budget, and a $3 billion plan to help Massachusetts prepare for extreme weather on the agenda on Beacon Hill. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon.
The State House and Senate have reached a deal over what parts of the legislative process they'd like to be made public. What does this deal look like?
Yeah, the focus here is on transparency at the committee level. So for the first time, members of the public would be guaranteed to know how their lawmakers vote on bills that they review in those committees. And there'll be new public access to written testimony. The idea being that people have the right to know not just where their lawmaker stands on a particular bill, but who's trying to sway them one way or another and what arguments are being made. There's also a whole bunch of kind of operational reforms that the House and the Senate are trying to put in place to avoid the kind of policy bottlenecks we saw at the end of last session with a marathon all-nighter that left several major bills unfinished. So I guess we'll stay tuned to see if those ultimately do pay off.
And speaking of the state legislature, where is the budget at this week as we approach July 1st, the start of the new fiscal year?
The budget is still jammed up in private talks between the House and the Senate. It does not appear as though we will start the fiscal year with a budget in place. But the governor did file a temporary budget, buying the House and Senate negotiators about another month to reach a deal here. This is, of course, as they are waiting for resolution of a budget bill at the federal level to give Massachusetts an idea how much federal money they are ultimately getting. The budget is built around the expectation that we'd receive $16 billion from the federal government, but it's unsure how much of that will ultimately materialize in the wake of the Trump administration's spending cuts and policy changes.
The governor's office this week filed a bill that seeks to borrow $3 billion to make Massachusetts more resilient in extreme weather events. So with so much vulnerable coastline in our region, it seems like this bill could have a big impact on us on the Cape, Coast, and Islands if it passes. Am I right to think that?
Oh, absolutely. There's a big focus on coastal resilience in this bill, although it does talk about extreme weather in places like central and western Massachusetts as well. Flooding and coastal erosion are a big deal here. There would be lots of money for shore protection, work on docks, beaches, salt marshes, and really working to find ways to help state and municipally owned dams and various flood control projects, from seawalls to jetties to nature-based solutions. There's also an effort in here to make sure that people would have more information about flood risks and past flooding before they buy or rent a home as a consumer protection measure.
And a piece of this bill sets aside money for clean water infrastructure and in particular PFAS remediation. How did that become part of the bill?
Contamination from the forever chemicals known as PFAS has really been an issue that Beacon Hill has had its eye on for a number of years now. There were new drinking water standards set in Massachusetts back in 2020 that set an upper limit on how much PFAS presence is suitable and what's not allowed. And this, too, is, of course, on the heels of a state law last year that would phase out the use of PFAS chemicals in firefighting gear. So it's something that really the state has been trying to tackle in a number of ways. And even back in 2022, when there was a statewide interagency task force on PFAS hazards, they acknowledged in that group's report that this was something that was going to cost a lot of money to fix, to tackle this really pervasive problem. You know, high levels of PFAS have been found in dozens of communities across the state.
All right. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod awarding over $100,000 to support creative projects across the region. Executive Director Julie Wake joins us with this positive news. Hey, Julie.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Just a couple minutes, but I had to get this in there because we had that awful news in May about the National Endowment of the Arts pulling back money. And here we are now. Tell us a little bit about the grants and a number of projects.
Yes, we are funding 31 recipients, although we did have 89 applications. We were only able to provide grants for about 31 recipients, $107,000. And back in May, this was part of a matching NEA grant of $40,000, and then we heard from the NEA through the Trump administration's changes that the grant had been rescinded. Mm-hmm. So we were able to make up the funding with partnerships like the Cape Cod Foundation and some other private donations. And so we were able to fill that gap. And as a result, 18 organizations and 13 artists are receiving funding for things like increasing access to the arts for families and kids, innovative projects that are unique to the area, like talking about housing through the power of arts, memory loss, cultural connections. We're also, you know, we prioritized ensuring fair artist compensation in projects. And so it's been a really interesting, thoughtful process this time around, for sure.
We're only about 30 seconds left, but 89 applications. So for the folks who didn't get them this time around, do you encourage them to apply the next round?
Always apply. And it was totaled over $625,000 in requests.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, we wish that we could fund everything. But obviously we can't. And especially right now it's tight. So we are going to continue to fundraise and spread the good word and try to support artists as best we can in other ways. You know, supporting their work and, you know, with marketing efforts and that sort of thing. So,
all right. Executive Director Julie Wake from the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
That wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.